down. The ground was only 6 kilometers below, but the arch of the sky was 10 kilometers overhead. The city of London was hanging up there near the zenith. New York, on the other hand, was the right way up, directly ahead.
Dragonfly, said Hub Control, you're getting a little low. 2,200 meters from the axis.
Thanks, he replied. I'll gain altitude. Let me know when I'm back at 20. This was something he'd have to watch. There was a natural tendency to lose height, and he had no instruments to tell him exactly where he was. If he got too far away from the zero gravity of the axis, he might never be able to climb back to it. Fortunately, there was a wide margin for error, and there was always someone watching his progress through a telescope at the hub. He was now well out over the sea, pedaling along at a steady 20 kilometers an hour. In 5 minutes, he would be over New York. Already, the island looked rather like a ship, sailing forever round and round the cylindrical sea. When he reached New York, he flew a circle over it, stopping several times so that his little TV camera could send back steady, vibration-free images. The panorama of buildings, towers, industrial plants, power stations, or whatever they were, was fascinating, but essentially meaningless. No matter how long he stared at its complexity, he was unlikely to learn anything. The camera would record far more details than he could possibly assimilate, and one day, perhaps years hence, some student might find in them the key to Rama's secrets. After leaving New York, he crossed the other half of the sea in only 15 minutes. Though he was not aware of it, he had been flying fast over water, but as soon as he reached the south coast, he unconsciously relaxed, and his speed dropped by several kilometers an hour. He might be in wholly alien territory, but at least he was over land. As soon as he had crossed the great cliff that formed the sea's southern limit, he panned the TV camera completely around the circle of the world.
Beautiful, said Hub Control. This will keep the mapmakers happy. How are you feeling?
I'm fine. Just a little fatigue, but no more than I expected. How far do you make me from the pole?
15.6 kilometers.
Tell me when I'm at 10. I'll take a rest then. And make sure I don't get low again. I'll start climbing when I've 5 to go.
20 minutes later, the world was closing in upon him. He had come to the end of the cylindrical section and was entering the southern dome. He had studied it for hours through the telescopes at the other end of Rama and had learned its geography by heart. Even so, that had not fully prepared him for the spectacle all around him. In almost every way, the southern and northern ends of Rama differed completely. Here was no triad of stairways, no series of narrow, concentric plateaus, no sweeping curve from hub to plain. Instead, there was an immense central spike, more than 5 kilometers long, extending along the axis. 6 smaller ones, half the size, were equally spaced around it. The whole assembly looked like a group of remarkably symmetrical stalactites hanging from the roof of a cave, or, inverting the point of view, the spires of some Cambodian temple set at the bottom of a crater. Linking these slender, tapering towers, and curving down from them to merge eventually in the cylindrical plain, were flying buttresses that looked massive enough to bear the weight of a world. And this, perhaps, was their function, if they were indeed the elements of some exotic drive units, as had been suggested. Jimmy approached the central spike cautiously, stopped pedaling while he was still 100 meters away, and let Dragonfly drift to rest. He checked the radiation level and found only Rama's very low background. There might be forces at work here that no human instruments could detect, but that was another unavoidable risk.
What can you see? Hub Control asked anxiously.
Just Bighorn. It's absolutely smooth, no markings, and the point's so sharp you could use it as a needle. I'm almost scared to go near it.
He was only half joking. It seemed incredible that so massive an object should taper to such a geometrically perfect point. Jimmy had seen collections of insects impaled upon pins, and he had no desire for his own dragonfly to meet a similar fate. He pedaled slowly forward until the spike had flared out to several meters in diameter, and stopped again. Opening a small container, he rather gingerly extracted a sphere about as big as a baseball, and tossed it toward the spike. As it drifted away, it played out a barely visible thread. The sticky bomb hit the smoothly curving surface and did not rebound. Jimmy gave the thread an experimental twitch, then a harder tug. Like a fisherman hauling in his catch, he slowly wound Dragonfly across to the tip of the appropriately christened Big Horn until he was able to put out his hand and make contact with it.
I suppose you could call this some kind of touchdown, he reported to Hub Control. It feels like glass, almost frictionless and slightly warm. The sticky bomb worked fine. Now I'm trying the mic. Let's see if the suction pad holds as well. Plugging in the leads. Anything coming through?
There was a long pause. Then Hub Control said disgustedly,
Not a damn thing, except the usual thermal noises. Will you tap it with a piece of metal? Then at least we'll find if it's hollow.
Okay. Now what?
We'd like you to fly along the spike, making a complete scan every half kilometer, and looking out for anything unusual. Then, if you're sure it's safe, you might go across to one of the little horns, but only if you're certain you can get back to zero G without any problems.
3 kilometers from the axis? That's slightly above lunar gravity. Dragonfly was designed for that. I'll just have to work harder.
Jimmy, this is the captain. I've got second thoughts on that. Judging by your pictures, the smaller spikes are just the same as the big one. Get the best coverage of them you can with the zoom lens. I don't want you leaving the low gravity region unless you see something that looks very important. Then we'll talk it over.
Okay, Skipper, said Jimmy, and perhaps there was just a trace of relief in his voice. I'll stay close to Bighorn. Here we go again.
He felt he was dropping straight downward into a narrow valley between a group of incredibly tall and slender mountains. Bighorn now towered a kilometer above him, and the 6 spikes of the Little Horns were looming up all around. The complex of buttresses and flying arches that surrounded the lower slopes was approaching rapidly. He wondered if he could make a safe landing somewhere down there in that cyclopean architecture. He could no longer land on Bighorn itself, for the gravity on its widening slopes was now too powerful to be counteracted by the feeble force of the sticky bomb. As he came ever closer to the South Pole, he began to feel more and more like a sparrow flying beneath the vaulted roof of some great cathedral, though no cathedral ever built had been even 1/100th the size of this place. He wondered if it was indeed a religious shrine, or something remotely analogous, but quickly dismissed the idea. Nowhere in Rama had there been any trace of artistic expression. Everything was purely functional. Perhaps the Ramans felt that they already knew the ultimate secrets of the universe and were no longer haunted by the yearnings and aspirations that drove mankind. That was a chilling thought, quite alien to Jimmy's usually not very profound philosophy. He felt an urgent need to resume human contact, and reported his situation back to his distant friends.
"Say again, Dragonfly," replied Hub Control. "We can't understand you. Your transmission is garbled."
"I repeat, I'm near the base of Little Horn Number 6, and am using the sticky bomb to haul myself in."
"Understand only partially. Can you hear me?"
"Yes, perfectly. Repeat, perfectly."
"Please start counting numbers."
1, 2, 3, 4.
"Got part of that. Give us beacon for 15 seconds, then go back to voice."
"Here it is."
Jimmy switched on the low-powered beacon that would locate him anywhere inside Rama, and counted off the seconds. When he went over to voice again, he asked plaintively,
"What's happening? Can you hear me now?"
Presumably Hub Control didn't, because the controller then asked for 15 seconds of TV. Not until Jimmy had repeated the question twice did the message get through.
"Glad you can hear us okay, Jimmy, but there's something very peculiar happening at your end. Listen."
Over the radio, he heard the familiar whistle of his own beacon played back to him. For a moment, it was perfectly normal. Then a weird distortion crept into it. The thousand-cycle whistle became modulated by a deep, throbbing pulse so low that it was almost beneath the threshold of hearing. It was a kind of basso profundo flutter in which each individual vibration could be heard, and the modulation was itself modulated. It rose and fell, rose and fell, with a period of about 5 seconds. Never for a moment did it occur to Jimmy that there was something wrong with his radio transmitter. This was from outside, though what it was and what it meant was beyond his imagination. Hub Control was not much wiser, but at least it had a theory.
"We think you must be in some kind of very intense field, probably magnetic, with a frequency of about 10 cycles. It may be strong enough to be dangerous. Suggest you get out right away. It may be only local. Switch on your beacon again, and we'll play it back to you. Then you can tell when you're getting clear of the interference."
Jimmy hastily jerked the sticky bomb loose and abandoned his attempt to land. He swung Dragonfly around in a wide circle, listening as he did so to the sound that wavered in his earphones. After flying only a few meters, he could tell that its intensity was falling rapidly. As Hub Control had guessed, it was extremely localized. He paused at the last spot where he could hear it, like a faint throbbing deep in his brain. So might a primitive savage have listened in awe-struck ignorance to the low humming of a giant power transformer, and even the savage might have guessed that the sound he heard was merely the stray leakage from colossal energies fully controlled, but biding their time. Whatever this sound meant, Jimmy was glad to be clear of it. This was no place, among the overwhelming architecture of the South Pole, for a lone man to listen to the voice of Rama. 27. Electric Wind. As Jimmy turned homeward, the northern end of Rama seemed incredibly far away. Even the three giant stairways were barely visible, as a faint Y etched on the dome that closed the world. The band of the cylindrical sea was a wide and menacing barrier, waiting to swallow him, like Icarus, if his fragile wings should fail. But he had come all this way with no problems, and though he was feeling slightly tired, he now felt that he had nothing to worry about. He had not even touched his food or water, and had been too excited to rest. On the return journey, he would relax and take it easy. He was also cheered by the thought that the homeward trip could be 20 kilometers shorter than the outward one, for as long as he cleared the sea, he could make an emergency landing anywhere in the northern hemisphere. That would be a nuisance, because he would have a long walk, and much worse, would have to abandon Dragonfly, but it gave him a comforting safety margin. He was now gaining altitude, climbing back toward the central spike. Bighorn's tapering needle still stretched for a kilometer ahead of him, and sometimes he felt it was the axis on which this whole world turned. He had almost reached the tip of Bighorn when he became aware of a curious sensation, a feeling of foreboding, and, indeed, of physical as well as psychological discomfort, had come over him. He suddenly recalled, and this did nothing at all to help, a phrase he had once come across. Someone is walking over your grave. At first, he shrugged it off and continued his steady pedaling. He certainly had no intention of reporting anything as tenuous as a vague malaise to Hub Control. But as it grew steadily worse, he was tempted to do so. It could not possibly be psychological. If it was, his mind was much more powerful than he realized. And he could, quite literally, feel his skin beginning to crawl. Now, seriously alarmed, he stopped in mid-air to consider the situation. What made it all the more peculiar was the fact that this depressed, heavy feeling was not completely novel. He had known it before, but could not remember where. He looked around him. Nothing had changed. The great spike of Bighorn was a few hundred meters above, with the other side of Rama spanning the sky beyond that. 8 kilometers below lay the complicated patchwork of the southern continent, full of wonders that no other man would ever see. In all the utterly alien, yet now familiar, landscape, he could find no cause for his discomfort. Something was tickling the back of his hand. For a moment he thought an insect had landed there, and brushed it away without looking. He had only half completed the swift motion when he realized what he was doing, and checked himself, feeling slightly foolish. Of course, no one had ever seen an insect in Rama. He lifted his hand and stared at it, mildly puzzled, because the tickling sensation was still there. It was then that he noticed that every individual hair was standing straight upright. All the way up his forearm it was the same, and so it was with his head when he checked with an exploring hand. So that was the trouble. He was in a tremendously powerful electric field. The oppressed, heavy sensation he had felt was that which sometimes precedes a thunderstorm on Earth. The sudden realization of his predicament brought Jimmy near to panic. Never before in his life had he been in real physical danger. Like all spacemen, he had known moments of frustration with bulky equipment, and times when, because of mistakes or inexperience, he had wrongly believed he was in a perilous situation. But none of these episodes had lasted more than a few minutes, and usually he was able to laugh at them almost at once. This time, there was no quick way out. He felt naked and alone in a suddenly hostile sky, surrounded by titanic forces that might discharge their furies at any moment. Dragonfly, already fragile enough, now seemed more insubstantial than the finest gossamer. The first detonation of the gathering storm would blast her to fragments. "Hub Control," he said urgently. "There's a static charge building up around me. I think there's going to be a thunderstorm at any moment." He had barely finished speaking when there was a flicker of light behind him. By the time he had counted 10, the first crackling rumble arrived. 3 kilometers. That put it back around the little horns. He looked toward them and saw that every one of the 6 needles seemed to be on fire. Brush discharges, hundreds of meters long, were dancing from their points, as if they were giant lightning conductors. What was happening back there could take place on an even larger scale near the tapering spike of Bighorn. His best move would be to get as far as possible from this dangerous structure and to seek clear air. He started to pedal again, accelerating as swiftly as he could without putting too great a strain on Dragonfly. At the same time, he began to lose altitude. Even though this would mean entering the region of higher gravity, he was now prepared to take such a risk. 8 kilometers was much too far from the ground for his peace of mind. The ominous black spike of Bighorn was still free of visible discharges, but he did not doubt that tremendous potentials were building up there. From time to time the thunder reverberated behind him, rolling round and round the circumference of the world. It suddenly occurred to Jimmy that it was strange to have such a storm in a perfectly clear sky. Then he realized that this was not a meteorological phenomenon at all. In fact, it might be only a trivial leakage of energy from some hidden source deep in the southern cap of Rama. But why now? And, even more important, what next? He was well past the tip of Bighorn, and hoped that he would soon be beyond the range of any lightning discharges. But now he had another problem. The air was becoming turbulent, and he had difficulty controlling Dragonfly. A wind seemed to have sprung up from nowhere, and if conditions became much worse, the Skybike's fragile skeleton would be endangered. He pedaled grimly on, trying to smooth out the buffeting by variations in power and movements of his body. Because Dragonfly was almost an extension of himself, he was partly successful. But he did not like the faint creaks of protest that came from the main spar, or the way in which the wings twisted with every gust. And there was something else that worried him. A faint, rushing sound, steadily growing in strength, that seemed to come from the direction of Bighorn. It sounded like gas escaping from a valve under great pressure, and he wondered if it had anything to do with the turbulence he was battling. Whatever its cause, it gave him yet further grounds for disquiet. From time to time, he reported these phenomena, rather briefly and breathlessly, to Hub Control. No one there could give him any advice, or even suggest what might be happening. But it was reassuring to hear the voices of his friends, even though he was now beginning to fear that he would never see them again. The turbulence was still increasing. It felt almost as if he was entering a jet stream, which he had once done, in search of a record, while flying a high-altitude glider on Earth. But what could possibly create a jet stream inside Rama? He had asked himself the right question. As soon as he had formulated it, he knew the answer. The sound he had heard was the electric wind carrying away the tremendous ionization that must be building up around Bighorn. Charged air was spraying out along the axis of Rama, and more air was flowing into the low-pressure region behind. He looked back at that gigantic and now doubly threatening needle, trying to visualize the boundaries of the gale that was blowing from it. Perhaps the best tactic would be to fly by ear, getting as far as possible away from the ominous hissing. Rama spared him the necessity of choice. A sheet of flame burst out behind him, filling the sky. He had time to see it split into 6 ribbons of fire, stretching from the tip of Bighorn to each of the little horns. Then the concussion reached him. 28. Icarus. Jimmy had barely time to radio, "The wing's buckling! I'm going to crash!" when Dragonfly started to fold up gracefully around him. The left wing snapped cleanly in the middle, and the outer section drifted away like a gently falling leaf. The right wing put up a more complicated performance. It twisted around at the root and angled back so sharply that its tip became entangled in the tail. Jimmy felt that he was sitting in a broken kite, slowly falling down the sky. Yet he was not quite helpless. The air screw still worked, and while he had power, there was still some measure of control. He had perhaps 5 minutes in which to use it. Was there any hope of reaching the sea? No, it was much too far away. Then he remembered that he was thinking in terrestrial terms. Though he was a good swimmer, it would be hours before he could possibly be rescued, and in that time the poisonous waters would undoubtedly have killed him. His only hope was to come down on land. The problem of the sheer southern cliff he would think about later, if there was any later. He was falling very slowly, here in this tenth of a gravity zone, but would soon start to accelerate as he got farther away from the axis. However, air drag would complicate the situation and would prevent him from building up too swift a rate of descent. Dragonfly, even without power, would act as a crude parachute. The few kilograms of thrust he could still provide might make all the difference between life and death. That was his only hope. Hub had stopped talking. His friends could see exactly what was happening to him and knew that there was no way their words could help. Jimmy was now doing the most skillful flying of his life. It was too bad, he thought with grim humor, that his audience was so small and could not appreciate the finer details of his performance. He was going down in a wide spiral, and as long as its pitch remained fairly flat, his chances of survival were good. His pedaling was helping to keep Dragonfly airborne, though he was afraid to exert maximum power in case the broken wings came completely adrift. And every time he swung southward, he could appreciate the fantastic display that Rama had kindly arranged for his benefit. The streamers of lightning still played from the tip of Bighorn down to the lesser peaks beneath, but now the whole pattern was rotating. The six-pronged crown of fire was turning against the spin of Rama, making one revolution every few seconds. Jimmy felt that he was watching a giant electric motor in operation, and perhaps that was not hopelessly far from the truth. He was halfway down to the plane, orbiting in a flat spiral, when the fireworks display suddenly ceased. He could feel the tension drain from the sky, and knew, without looking, that the hairs on his arms were no longer straining upright. There was nothing to distract or hinder him now, during the last few minutes of his fight for life. Now that he could be certain of the general area in which he must land, he started to study it intently. Much of this region was a checkerboard of totally conflicting environments, as if a mad landscape gardener had been given a free hand and told to exercise his imagination to the utmost. The squares of the checkerboard were almost a kilometer on a side, and though most of them were flat, he could not be sure if they were solid, because their colors and textures varied so greatly. He decided to wait until the last possible minute before making a decision, if, indeed, he had any choice. When there were a few hundred meters to go, he made a last call to the hub. "I've still got some control.
We'll be down in half a minute. We'll call you then.
That was optimistic, and everyone knew it. But he refused to say goodbye. He wanted his comrades to know that he had gone down fighting, and without fear. Actually, he felt little fear, and this surprised him, for he had never thought of himself as a particularly brave man. It was almost as if he were watching the struggles of a complete stranger, and was not himself personally involved. Rather, he was studying an interesting problem in aerodynamics, and changing various parameters to see what would happen. Almost the only emotion he felt was a certain remote regret for lost opportunities, of which the most important was the forthcoming Lunar Olympics. One future, at least, was decided. Dragonfly would never show her paces on the moon. 100 meters to go. His ground speed seemed acceptable, but how fast was he falling? And here was one piece of luck. The terrain was completely flat. He would put forth all his strength in a final burst of power, starting now. The right wing, having done its duty, finally tore off at the roots. Dragonfly started to roll over, and he tried to correct by throwing the weight of his body against the spin. He was looking directly at the curving arch of landscape 16 kilometers away when he hit. It seemed altogether unfair and unreasonable that the sky should be so hard.
29. First Contact. When Jimmy returned to consciousness, the first thing he became aware of was a splitting headache. He almost welcomed it. At least it proved that he was alive. Then he tried to move, and at once a wide selection of aches and pains brought themselves to his attention. But as far as he could tell, nothing seemed to be broken. After that, he risked opening his eyes, but closed them at once when he found himself staring straight into the band of light along the ceiling of the world. As a cure for a headache, that view was not recommended. He was still lying there, regaining his strength and wondering how soon it would be safe to open his eyes, when there was a sudden crunching noise from close at hand. Turning his head slowly toward the source of the sound, he risked a look, and almost lost consciousness again. Not more than 5 meters away, a large, crab-like creature was apparently dining on the wreckage of poor Dragonfly. When Jimmy had recovered his wits, he rolled slowly and quietly away from the monster, expecting at every moment to be seized by its claws when it discovered that more appetizing fare was available. However, it took not the slightest notice of him. When he had increased their mutual separation to 10 meters, he cautiously propped himself up in a sitting position. From this greater distance, the thing did not appear quite so formidable. It had a low, flat body, about 2 meters long and 1 wide, supported on 6 triple-jointed legs. Jimmy saw that he was mistaken in assuming that it had been eating Dragonfly. In fact, he could not see any sign of a mouth. The creature was actually doing a neat job of demolition, using scissor-like claws to chop the skybike into small pieces. A whole row of manipulators, which looked uncannily like tiny human hands, then transferred the fragments to a steadily growing pile on the animal's back. But was it an animal? Though that had been Jimmy's first reaction, now he had second thoughts. There was a purposefulness about its behavior that suggested fairly high intelligence. He could see no reason why any creature of pure instinct should carefully collect the scattered pieces of his skybike, unless
Perhaps. It was gathering material for a nest. Keeping a wary eye on the crab, which still ignored him completely, Jimmy struggled to his feet. A few wavering steps demonstrated that he could walk, though he was not sure if he could outdistance those six legs. Then he switched on his radio, never doubting that it would still be operating. A crash that he could survive would not even have been noticed by its solid-state electronics.
"Hub control," he said softly, "can you receive me?"
"Thank God, are you okay?"
"Just a bit shaken. Take a look at this."
He turned his camera toward the crab, just in time to record the final demolition of Dragonfly's wing.
"What the devil is it? And why is it chewing up your bike?"
"Wish I knew. It's finished with Dragonfly. I'm going to back away, in case it wants to start on me."
Jimmy slowly retreated, never taking his eyes off the crab. It was now moving round and round in a steadily widening spiral, apparently searching for fragments it might have overlooked, and so Jimmy was able to get an overall view of it for the first time. Now that the initial shock had worn off, he could appreciate that it was quite a handsome beast. The name Crab, which he had automatically given to it, was perhaps a little misleading. If it had not been so impossibly large, he might have called it a beetle. Its carapace had a beautiful metallic sheen. He would almost have been prepared to swear that it was metal. That was an interesting idea. Could it be a robot and not an animal? He stared at the crab intently with this thought in mind, analyzing all the details of its anatomy. Where it should have had a mouth was a collection of manipulators that reminded Jimmy strongly of the multipurpose knives that are the delight of all red-blooded boys. There were pinchers, probes, rasps, and even something that looked like a drill. But this was not decisive. On Earth, the insect world had matched all these tools, and many more. The animal or robot question remained in perfect balance in his mind. The eyes, which might have settled the matter, left it even more ambiguous. They were so deeply recessed in protective hoods that it was impossible to tell whether their lenses were made of crystal or of jelly. They were quite expressionless and of a startling vivid blue. Though they had been directed toward Jimmy several times, they had never shown the slightest flicker of interest. In his, perhaps, biased opinion, that decided the level of the creature's intelligence. An entity, robot or animal, which could ignore a human being, could not be very bright. It had stopped its circling and stood still for a few seconds, as if listening to some inaudible message. Then it set off, with a curious rolling gait, in the general direction of the sea. It moved in a perfectly straight line at a steady 4 or 5 kilometers an hour, and had already traveled a couple of 100 meters before Jimmy's still slightly shocked mind registered the fact that the last sad relics of his beloved dragonfly were being carried away from him. He set off in hot and indignant pursuit. His action was not wholly illogical. The crab was heading toward the sea, and if any rescue was possible, it could be only from this direction. Moreover, he wanted to discover what the creature would do with its trophy. That should reveal something about its motivation and intelligence. Because he was bruised and stiff, it took Jimmy several minutes to catch up with the purposefully moving crab. When he had done so, he followed it at a respectful distance until he felt sure that it did not resent his presence. It was then that he noticed his water flask and emergency ration pack among the debris of Dragonfly, and felt instantly both hungry and thirsty. There, scuttling away from him at a remorseless 5 kilometers an hour, was the only food and drink in all this half of the world. Whatever the risk, he had to get hold of it. He cautiously closed in on the crab, approaching from the right rear. While he kept station with it, he studied the complicated rhythm of its legs until he could anticipate where they would be at any moment. When he was ready, he muttered a quick, "Excuse me," and shot swiftly in to grab his property. Jimmy had never dreamed that he would one day have to exercise the skills of a pickpocket, but he was delighted with his success. He was out again in less than a second, and the crab never slackened its steady pace. He dropped back a dozen meters, moistened his lips from the flask, and started to chew a bar of meat concentrate. The little victory made him feel much happier. Now he could even risk thinking about his somber future. While there was life, there was hope. Yet he could imagine no way in which he could possibly be rescued. Even if his colleagues crossed the sea, how could he reach them 0.5 kilometer below?
"We'll find a way down somehow,"
Hub Control had promised.
"That cliff can't go right around the world without a break anywhere."
He had been tempted to answer, "Why not?" but had thought better of it. One of the strangest things about walking inside Rama was that you could always see your destination. Here, the curve of the world did not hide, it revealed. For some time, Jimmy had been aware of the crab's objective. Up there in the land that seemed to rise before him was a 0.5 kilometer wide pit. It was one of 3 in the southern hemisphere. From the hub, it had been impossible to see how deep they were. All had been named after prominent lunar craters, and he was approaching Copernicus. The name was hardly appropriate, for there were no surrounding hills and no central peaks. This Copernicus was merely a deep shaft, or well, with perfectly vertical sides. When he came close enough to look into it, Jimmy was able to see a pool of ominous, leaden-green water at least 0.5 kilometer below. This would put it just about level with the sea, and he wondered if they were connected. Winding down the interior of the well was a spiral ramp, completely recessed into the sheer wall, so that the effect was rather like that of rifling in an immense gun barrel. There seemed to be a remarkable number of turns. Not until Jimmy had traced them for several revolutions, getting more and more confused in the process, did he realize that there was not one ramp, but 3, totally independent and 120 degrees apart. In any other background than Rama, the whole concept would have been an impressive architectural tour de force. The 3 ramps led straight down into the pool and disappeared beneath its opaque surface. Near the waterline, Jimmy could see a group of black tunnels, or caves. They looked rather sinister, and he wondered if they were inhabited. Perhaps the Ramans were amphibious. As the crab approached the edge of the well, Jimmy assumed that it was going to descend one of the ramps, perhaps taking the wreckage of Dragonfly to some entity who would be able to evaluate it. Instead, the creature walked straight to the brink, extended almost 0.5 its body over the gulf without any sign of hesitation, though an error of a few centimeters would have been disastrous, and gave a brisk shrug. The fragments of Dragonfly went fluttering down into the depths. There were tears in Jimmy's eyes as he watched them go. So much, he thought bitterly, for this creature's intelligence. Having disposed of the garbage, the crab swung around and started to walk toward Jimmy, standing only about 10 meters away. "Am I going to get the same treatment?" he wondered. He hoped the camera was not too unsteady as he showed Hub Control the rapidly approaching monster.
What do you advise?
He whispered anxiously, without much hope that he would get a useful answer. It was some small consolation to realize that he was making history, and his mind raced through the approved patterns for such a meeting. Until now, all of these had been purely theoretical. He would be the first man to check them in practice.
Don't run until you're sure it's hostile, Hub Control whispered back at him.
Run where? Jimmy asked himself. He thought he could outdistance the thing in 100-meter sprint, but he had a sick certainty that it could wear him down over the long haul. Slowly, Jimmy held up his outstretched hands. Men had been arguing for 200 years about this gesture. Would every creature, everywhere in the universe, interpret this as, see, no weapons, but no one could think of anything better? The crab showed no reaction whatsoever, nor did it slacken its pace. Ignoring Jimmy completely, it walked straight past him and headed purposefully into the south. Feeling extremely foolish, the acting representative of Homo sapiens watched his first contact stride away across the Raman plain, totally indifferent to his presence. He had seldom been so humiliated in his life. Then his sense of humor came to the rescue. After all, it was no great matter to have been ignored by an animated garbage truck. It would have been worse if it had greeted him as a long-lost brother. He walked back to the rim of Copernicus and stared down into its opaque waters. For the first time, he noticed that vague shapes, some of them quite large, were moving slowly back and forth beneath the surface. Presently, one of them headed toward the nearest spiral ramp, and something that looked like a multi-legged tank started on the long ascent. At the rate it was going, Jimmy decided, it would take almost an hour to get here. If it was a threat, it was a very slow-moving one. Then he noticed a flicker of much more rapid movement near those cave-like openings down by the waterline. Something was traveling swiftly along the ramp, but he could not focus clearly upon it, or discern any definite shape. It was as if he was looking at a small whirlwind, or dust devil, about the size of a man. He blinked and shook his head, keeping his eyes closed for several seconds. When he opened them again, the apparition was gone. Perhaps the impact had shaken him up more than he had realized. This was the first time he had ever suffered from visual hallucinations. He would not mention it to Hub Control. Nor would he bother to explore these ramps, as he had half thought of doing. It would obviously be a waste of energy. The spinning phantom he had merely imagined seeing had nothing to do with his decision. Nothing at all, for, of course, Jimmy did not believe in ghosts. 30. The Flower. Jimmy's exertions had made him thirsty, and he was acutely conscious of the fact that in all this land there was no water that a man could drink. With the contents of his flask, he could probably survive a week. But for what purpose? The best brains of Earth would soon be focused on his problem, and doubtless Commander Norton would be bombarded with suggestions. But he could imagine no way in which he could lower himself down the face of that half-kilometer cliff. Even if he had a long enough rope, there was no place to which he could attach it. Nevertheless, it was foolish and unmanly to give up without a struggle. Any help would have to come from the sea, and while he was marching toward it, he could carry on with his job as if nothing had happened. No one else would ever observe and photograph the varied terrains through which he must pass, and that would guarantee a posthumous immortality. Though he would have preferred many other honors, that was better than nothing. He was only 3 kilometers from the sea, as poor Dragonfly could have flown, but it seemed unlikely that he could reach it in a straight line. Some of the terrain ahead of him might prove too great an obstacle. That was no problem, however, because there were plenty of alternative routes. He could see them all, spread out on the great curving map that swept up and away from him on either side. He had plenty of time. He would start with the most interesting scenery, even if it took him off his direct route. About 1 kilometer away to the right was a square that glittered like cut glass, or a gigantic display of jewelry. It was probably this thought that triggered Jimmy's footsteps. Even a doomed man might reasonably be expected to take some slight interest in a few thousand square meters of gems. He was not particularly disappointed when they turned out to be quartz crystals, millions of them set in a bed of sand. The adjacent square of the checkerboard was rather more interesting. It was covered with an apparently random pattern of hollow metal columns, set close together and ranging in height from less than 1 to more than 5 meters. It was completely impassable. Only a tank could have crashed through that forest of tubes. Jimmy walked between the crystals and the columns until he came to the first crossroads. The square on the right was a huge rug or tapestry made of woven wire. He tried to prise a strand loose, but was unable to break it. On the left was a tessellation of hexagonal tiles, so smoothly inlaid that there were no visible joints between them. It would have appeared a continuous surface had the tiles not been colored all the hues of the rainbow. Jimmy spent many minutes trying to find 2 adjacent tiles of the same color, to see if he could then distinguish their boundaries, but he could not find a single example of such a coincidence. As he did a slow pan right around the crossroads, he said plaintively to Hub Control, "What do you think this is? I feel I'm trapped in a giant jigsaw puzzle. Or is this the Ramen Art Gallery?" "We're as baffled as you, Jimmy. But there's never been any sign that the Ramens go in for art. Let's wait until we have some more examples before we jump to any conclusions." The 2 examples he found at the next crossroads were not much help. One was completely blank. A smooth, neutral gray, hard, but slippery to the touch. The other was a soft sponge, perforated with billions upon billions of tiny holes. He tested it with his foot, and the whole surface undulated sickeningly beneath him like a barely stabilized quicksand. At the next crossroads, he encountered something strikingly like a plowed field, except that the furrows were a uniform meter in depth, and the material of which they were made had the texture of a file or rasp. But he paid little attention to this, because the square adjacent to it was the most thought-provoking of all that he had seen. At last, there was something that he could understand, and it was more than a little disturbing. The entire square was surrounded by a fence, so conventional that he would not have looked at it twice had he seen it on Earth. There were posts, apparently of metal, 5 meters apart, with 6 strands of wire strung taut between them. Beyond this fence was a 2nd identical one, and beyond that, 1/3. It was another example of Rama redundancy. Whatever was penned inside this enclosure would have no chance of breaking out. There was no entrance, no gates that could be swung open to drive in the beast or beasts that were presumably kept here. Instead, there was a single hole, like a smaller version of Copernicus, in the center of the square. Even in different circumstances, Jimmy would probably not have hesitated, but now he had nothing to lose. He quickly scaled all three fences, walked over to the hole, and peered into it. Unlike Copernicus, this well was only 50 meters deep. There were three tunnel exits at the bottom, each of which looked large enough to accommodate an elephant. And that was all. After staring for some time, Jimmy decided that the only thing that made sense about the arrangement was for the floor down there to be an elevator. But what it elevated, he was never likely to know. He could only guess that it was quite large, and possibly quite dangerous. During the next few hours, he walked more than 10 kilometers along the edge of the sea, and the checkerboard squares had begun to blur together in his memory. He had seen some that were totally enclosed in tent-like structures of wire mesh, as if they were giant bird cages. There were others that seemed to be pools of congealed liquid, full of swirl patterns. However, when he tested them gingerly, they were quite solid. And there was one so utterly black that he could not even see it clearly. Only the sense of touch told him that anything was there. Yet now, there was a subtle modulation into something he could understand. Ranging one after the other toward the south was a series of, no other word would do, fields. He might have been walking past an experimental farm on Earth. Each square was a smooth expanse of carefully leveled earth or dirt, the first he had ever seen in the metallic landscape of Rama. The great fields were virgin, lifeless, waiting for crops that had never been planted. Jimmy wondered what their purpose could be, since it was incredible that creatures as advanced as the Ramans would engage in any form of agriculture. Even on Earth, farming was no more than a popular hobby and a source of exotic luxury foods. But he could swear that these were potential farms, immaculately prepared. He had never seen dirt that looked so clean. Each square was covered with a great sheet of tough, transparent plastic. He tried to cut through it to obtain a sample, but his knife would barely scratch the surface. Farther inland were other fields, and on many of them were complicated constructions of rods and wires, presumably intended for the support of climbing plants. They looked bleak and desolate, like leafless trees in the depths of winter. The winter they had known must have been long and terrible indeed, and these few weeks of light and warmth might be only a brief interlude before it came again. Jimmy never knew what made him stop and look more closely into the metal maze to the south. Unconsciously, his mind must have been checking every detail around him. It had noticed, in this fantastically alien landscape, something even more anomalous. About a quarter of a kilometer away, in the middle of a trellis of wires and rods, glowed a single speck of color. It was so small and inconspicuous that it was almost at the limit of visibility. On Earth, no one would have looked at it twice. Yet undoubtedly, one of the reasons he had noticed it now was because it reminded him of Earth. He did not report to Hub Control until he was sure that there was no mistake, and that wishful thinking had not deluded him. Not until he was only a few meters away could he be completely sure that life as he knew it had intruded into the sterile, aseptic world of Rama. Here, blooming in lonely splendor at the edge of the southern hemisphere, was a flower. As he came closer, it was obvious to Jimmy that something had gone wrong. There was a hole in the sheathing that, presumably, protected this layer of dirt from contamination by unwanted life forms. Through this break extended a green stem, about as thick as a man's little finger, which twined its way up through the trellis work. A meter from the ground, it burst into an efflorescence.